This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Quinney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about the juvenile justice system. If there's someone you know or someone in your family who's having a difficulty with the law and this person is under 18, you might want to listen to what we're going to talk about. My guests are Santa Clara County Superior Court Judges Kurt Cumley and Judge Eugene Hyman, recently retired, Santa Clara County Deputy District Attorney LaRon Hogue-Haught, and San Francisco County Deputy Public Defender Greg Feldman. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the San Mateo County Bar Association, the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, and the Family Law Section of the State Bar. And I welcome the four of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. How does a young person, he or she, get himself or herself into the juvenile justice system? What's been going on? What are these kids doing?
These days, it's all about iPhones. Probably 50% of my caseload right now is iPhone robberies, minibus iPhone robberies.
This is Greg Feldman. Greg, they're stealing people's iPhones.
Correct. There is the old-fashioned notion of haves and have-nots is alive and well, especially in San Francisco, where I practice. And you've got people walking around out there with $500, essentially, in their hand as they're walking down the street and not paying attention.
How does law enforcement find these kids who have stolen someone's iPhone? What's the general thing? Because I'm not big on electronics, but I do have a cell phone. I have a phone at home also, but go ahead.
In San Francisco, you go down to the corner of 7th and Market or 6th and Market.
Oh, you can buy one of those.
You can sell one and buy one. You can turn one over within a couple of minutes. I mean, kids know. There's literally a menu out there.
That's the hot spot. All right. One of the things that I understand with juveniles is that once you have, I presume it's a felony in the juvenile justice system, it never goes away. I wonder if you talk about that a bit. Judge Hyman, would you do that?
I don't think it's an accurate statement to say it never goes away. It depends upon what the crime is. If it's what's referred to as a 707B offense of the Welfare and Institutions Code, which is serious felonies, if it's a strike offense, it'll never go away. But there is record sealing, but you're not going to get record sealing with respect to serious juvenile felonies. And under California law, if you have a strike offense, it can be used against you at the discretion of the district attorney in an adult situation. And unfortunately, under California law, you can't get a juvenile pardon. So virtually it's out there. And of course, in serious cases of juveniles, 14 for certain crimes, 16 for others, you can be direct filed in adult court. Actually, in certain cases, you might be able to get an adult case sealed, but that would only be if you were given probation, which probably isn't going to happen if they're direct filing.
When you talk about a strike, give a couple of examples so that we all know what you're talking
robbery,
about.
Robbery, rape, murder, attempted murder. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Serious threats, criminal threats, those are strike offenses.
If talking about an iPhone, and the value of them is $500.
That's grand theft.
That's grand theft. That's a felony.
Yes, but if it's just grand theft, that you can seal. Mm-hmm. If it's taken by force or fear, that's robbery, in which case it can't be sealed.
All right.
And what that translates into is if there's the slightest little tussle between the owner of the phone and the person trying to take it.
So that's robbery.
That turns it into robbery. That's force.
That's very serious stuff.
Not only that, that's a straight felony. In other words, it can't be reduced at the discretion of the court. It's totally up. I mean, hypothetically, as part of a plea bargain, a prosecutor could choose to reduce it to a grand theft person. But if there's resistance, almost always it's going to be robbery, which is a straight felony, and it's also a strike offense.
Chuck, this is Judge Cumley. I want to get back to your first question that Greg answered and tied it into Judge Hyman's answer a bit, which was, how does a child find themselves in the juvenile justice system? And it's important to realize that the phrase juvenile justice system is a broad term. It is both broadly defined in terms of what is the system. Does it mean contact with a school official that can result in a referral, contact with law enforcement, filing by the district attorney's office, going to court, being subject of the court's power and authority, or anything in between? But however you describe it, in California, it's important to remember that we don't really have a single juvenile justice system. What we have is 58 separate provincial systems of justice that are run by each of the counties, the county probation departments, the law enforcement agencies that work with those entities, and the DA's office, the public defenders, the private defense bar, and the courts. And they all have their same institutional memory, their same institutions, but the way in which they operate is markedly different. So if I take a cell phone as a 14-year-old, my journey through the juvenile justice system could be considerably different based upon what county I find myself, or what neighborhood in which county I find myself, which law enforcement entity I have the fortune or misfortune of coming in contact with, the quality of my representation, the nature of the district attorney. There is so much discretion, and that can be both good and bad, and so much variance county to county, that how a child comes into a juvenile justice system and whether or not they could suffer, based upon discretion, a lifetime of collateral consequences, the possibility of strike consequences that will follow them into the rest of their adulthood, or the inability to have one's record sealed, or having their matter handled informally so they actually never appear in front of a magistrate, or have a formal juvenile legal proceeding, is so different county to county, based upon the local culture and the amount of discretion that really is built into the system.
Can you tell us, basically, my understanding of the juvenile justice system is that one of the major goals is rehabilitation. Is that really, practically speaking, the case, Laurent, would you say?
Well, I would definitely say that's one of the goals. I don't want to sound too much like a prosecutor, but I will also say, and the code provides for the other goal to be protecting the community and accountability. So I would say rehabilitation is one of the goals.
Whereas in the adult system, we really don't have rehabilitation, do we?
Well,
practically speaking.
It's a fabulous question, because one of the distinctive characteristics of juvenile justice, and this is Judge Cumley, and I'm going to become Kurt in probably
the next 90
seconds
Kurt
or so.
And other Judge Eugene.
Yeah.
There we go. But, boy, it's a great question, because things vary so much place to place. But the one unifying characteristic that all counties within the state have is something that is called the Purpose Clause. That is, under California law, there is a specific statute that sets forth why juvenile courts exist. It's Welfare and Institutions Code Section 202. And it does talk about the need to preserve the family, rehabilitate youth, hold individuals accountable. It even allows for the concept of punishment, which, depending upon how it is meted out, can play into rehabilitation. But Laurent is clearly right when she says that rehabilitation is a goal, and as you point out, it is something that is codified under juvenile law and not codified under criminal law. But it is broader than that single, universal, commonly identified goal of the system.
Is there an issue of development of the juvenile brain that is a practical thing that the court, as well as all of the people who are working in the juvenile justice system, realize we're dealing with people whose brains have not developed, and therefore they really don't have the good common sense, let's hope, of the average adult. Lauren, what would you say about that?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think over the last few years, the system has begun to recognize that and is, in fact, developing ways to deal with kids that come into the system, taking that into account. We know that they're not going to have fully formed brains until well into their 20s. So we want to be able to develop ways to address their behavior that's developmentally appropriate, while still trying to find ways to hold them accountable for their, you know, illegal behavior, but recognizing that they're young, they make mistakes, and they don't always know exactly what they're doing.
Is there a greater percentage of young people in the juvenile justice system who are in minorities? Greg, please.
That's, I got to jump in on that
one
because that's something that, that scares the heck out of me. A conversation I have with my kids, my clients who are in custody all the time is stop for a moment and take a look around the unit. Average unit we've got, depending
this
on the population.
This is San Francisco now.
Exactly.
Yes.
So I tell my kids, look around the unit. And what do you see? What kind of numbers do you see? And what you're going to see is 60 to 70% African American.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see maybe 10% Asian, a lot of Latino kids. You're going to hardly ever see any white kids in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you look at the population numbers in San Francisco. I think the African American population in San Francisco is somewhere around 15 or 20%
mm-hmm.
right now.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck's going on? Where is that separation happening?
Mm-hmm. And that's true in other counties with a different percentage breakdown. Whether it's higher Latino representation. But I think you'll find in most counties there is a disproportionate number of minority kids in custodial facilities.
Are you saying that there is an element, a serious element of discrimination against minorities, or is this just that these young people, whether they're African Americans or they're Latino Americans, just are coming from families where they're deprived and they think, hey, I want to try to take the risk and do what I want to do.
Well,
Eugene, please.
Yes, thank you. I think there's a lot of issues there. I mean, one of the, and I totally agree with what Lauren had to say in terms of the hypothetical goals with respect to considering intervention and the juvenile brain. Unfortunately, again, and I agree with what Kurt had to say, you have 58 counties and 58 different ways of doing things. How we look at the juvenile brain depends upon what county you're in, depends upon the particular prosecutor, depends upon the particular philosophy of the juvenile unit of the DA's office, which can change depending upon who's in charge of that unit. But getting back to the issue of racial disparity. When you talk about dispositions, because you don't have sentencing in juvenile, you get a disposition.
But the disposition is just another word
for
absolutely.
Sentencing. Oh, absolutely. But
yeah.
Remember, the juvenile system has different words because it's not the adult system,
sure.
Although there's many people that believe that juveniles are just little adults, which they're not. But with respect to minority disproportionality, part of the problem when people are making recommendations in terms of probation, the lawyers, the judge, in terms of whether something should be done formally or informally, you look at the family, you look at the family support system, you look at the community support system, and unfortunately, many times minorities are at a disadvantage in terms of the support systems. And so when you don't have people that are involved or can't be involved, I'm not talking about just single parent families. I'm talking about where, unfortunately, due to the expense of living in the Bay Area, you have maybe one involved parent, but that person's working two jobs in order to put food on the table, mm-hmm. then the system's going to say, you know, unfortunately, if this parent could be available and could be part of working with us in terms of the system, then this kid wouldn't need to go to the ranch. No. This kid wouldn't need to go to a group home. But when there isn't anyone that's able to step up through no fault of the parent, then the system is likely to become more formal. And as a result of the system becoming more formal, this has a tendency, I think, to increase the disproportionality. When you're looking at African Americans, Latinos, Caucasians, Asians, and the like, you know, to the extent that you have family involvement in even two-parent families, you have more options, in which case then the formal option isn't necessarily the way that you have to go. And by formal, I mean where you're talking about juvenile hall, the ranches, or some kind of other...
Ranches are where, in many counties, where the young people go to rehabilitate.
Yeah, and Santa Clara County has a ranch system. Not every county does. Every county has a hall, but not every county has a ranch.
The hall, that's the juvenile justice system, and that's where some of these kids
Well,
stay.
that's a locked facility. Every county has a juvenile hall, but not every county has a ranch.
But so as we have 58 counties with 58 different juvenile justice systems, there are some universal identifiable problems that exist in each. One of them is disproportionality, and disproportionality rears its head racially, ethnically, socioeconomically. And there are people like James Bell at the Burns Institute that are national leaders that we have here locally in the Bay Area that really have some solutions about how to address these issues. But it isn't just what happens in court or what happens at the intake level with probation or the district attorney, because it isn't simply disproportionality of outcome. It is, as Greg suggested, disproportionality with regard to involvement in the system. And if you drill down further, disproportionality with regard to contact with law enforcement. And it ties back into, to a large extent, we're talking about the discretion factor. And I mentioned how different children have different experiences depending upon a number of variables. And Gene did a great job of explaining how those would work in the court setting. But ask yourself and imagine, and I'd ask all the listeners to imagine, two children from different neighborhoods, socioeconomic background, the idea of a safer neighborhood or an at-risk neighborhood, to coin a phrase, and law enforcement contact with children engaged in similar contact but in different neighborhoods, and the police response based upon the perceptions of options and public safety and the like. It begins there. But you asked a question about solutions. Mm-hmm. And solutions are interesting because the days of finding the point of institutional racism, does it exist with DAs, with cops, with judges? When you open up systems and look for that one issue, you're generally not going to find it. But what you're going to find is when you do that bloodletting, folks will see that they aren't contributing to the problem, but undeniably, as Greg points out, the problem exists. Yeah. So if no one takes ownership for it singularly, then where do we take ownership of it collectively to address this problem that Eugene mentioned, that I mentioned? And it really relates to the way that systems interact with one another, beginning not just with law enforcement, but in neighborhoods. And what is the neighborhood response to crime? What is the school response to crime? What is the law enforcement? How does probation interact with law enforcement? A example that some folks may be familiar with is the zero tolerance rule, which is this notion that if you do certain things, they have to get reported and people have to have certain outcomes based upon certain offenses, and that it takes discretion out of the system. But that is a false premise, because every journey through the criminal justice system begins with the characterization of a conduct by someone in law enforcement. Is a crime a grand theft or a robbery? Mm-hmm. Is something a simple battery or a felony assault? And you think that these things are definitions that are well-defined and established in the law.
And they are not.
It's an art, not a science.
Unfortunately. Let me do this. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about the juvenile justice system. For those of you who listen to us on the The live program will be, I'll be giving the phone number in a few minutes. You'll be able to join us with your questions, your comments, your concerns in the second half hour of the program, whether you're listening to us live in the Bay Area or on the internet at www.kalw.org. My guests are Santa Clara County Superior Court judges, Judge Kurt Cumley and Judge Eugene Hyman, who is recently retired, Santa Clara County Deputy District Attorney LaRon Hoghaut. Hot, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Hoff. Hoff. I'm going to move on. Pardon me for making that mistake. LaRon Hoghaut.
Hoghaut.
Hoghaut. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And San Francisco County Deputy District Attorney, pardon me, Public Defender Greg Feldman. I really was taken over the hoops on
my
that one.
My name does that to a lot of people.
I've been called worse, Jack.
I apologize for that. Here's a question that someone has brought in, and it's a good one. I think taxpayers would like to know why it costs an average $200,000 a year per juvenile incarcerated in state facilities. Despite all the money being spent, recidivism remains high among juvenile offenders. Where's the money going? Is this correct? Does it average $200,000 a year?
That was a figure, an approximation of a figure to house folks at the state facilities, which were formerly known as the California Youth Authority, are now the Division of Juvenile Facilities or Division of Juvenile Justice. I think that question is so well taken that the number of youth that were incarcerated at the state level has diminished from over 16,000 in the mid-90s to under 1,200 now. And so I think folks realize that it was a high-cost, low-yield proposition and that congregate care of youth far away from home, especially for kids that are both high risk and high needs, was not yielding great recidivism numbers. That is absolutely undeniable. What is implied by the question is the magic bullet question, which is what rehabilitates youth? And I'm guessing you have at least four answers to that question on this panel.
Where are the, I mean, we haven't gone from 16,000 to, you said how many, 1,200?
We're under 1,200
currently. Under 1,200. But we have other young people who are in the juvenile justice system, but not on the state level. Is that correct? They're in the county, they're in county programs, et cetera?
That's correct. There's a lot of kids in county programs. But there is this philosophy that we can't escape, which is if a kid's not making it at home, in the school, in the neighborhood where they live, we're going to remove the kid from that environment, and we're going to put them somewhere else that on some level is believed to provide structure. It's believed to help. It's believed to give a kid a way out. And it forgets that you're taking a kid away from home.
Yeah.
You're taking a kid away from the most important thing in their life. Even if their home is a mess, it's still home.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, what's interesting,
Eugene,
That when you remove a child from the home, whether it be in the juvenile justice, or also sometimes referred to as the delinquency system, or the abuse and neglect or dependency system, judge still has to make findings. And the findings are quite similar in the sense that the court has to be satisfied that the child cannot be assisted or the child's not safe, whether it be in dependency or whether it be in delinquency, and the child has to be removed. So there has to be findings that have to be made regardless of the system. So the system is weighted to try not to remove a child.
From the family.
From the family.
Well, and the elephant in the room after all of that is, so we remove them. We put them in a program which we think is fabulous and is going to make them better. And when they're done, they go right back to their family. So ultimately, in order to actually, quote unquote, rehabilitate the child, you actually need to be able to give them the skills to function back in their community when this is all over.
And is that being done, generally speaking?
Depends. Depends on the county, depends on the program, depends on the kid.
Aftercare and the ability, which is to say giving a child the ability to assimilate and succeed without confinement and institutionalization is something that I think we are evolving towards. There is still in the juvenile justice system the sense that, well, if Johnny committed a new offense after 30 days in the hall, we're going to give him 60 days in the hall next time, which there's no evidence to suggest that that works, that that yields a better result. But I want to go back to what we were talking about in terms of the differences between juveniles and adults, developmentally, mentally. This is something that's been identified and has really become a focal point, believe it or not, for our U.S. Supreme Court, and particularly Justice Kennedy, and three opinions that have come out in the last 5 years. The fundamental differences, both developmentally and mentally, between children and adults may hold the secret to what ultimately allows some children to rehabilitate, which is the great secret to juvenile rehabilitation is the same thing, Chuck, that caused you. I'm not suggesting you were a delinquent offender, but the thing that caused all of us to eventually conform our behaviors, delinquent or otherwise, to societal norms, and that is growing up. That is having a young brain become an older brain, reaching that 25, 26-year stage that Laurent was talking about earlier. And really, if the juvenile justice system committed to nothing more than having dispositional options that didn't make kids worse. Mm-hmm. You know, if we adopted the medical ethic, do no harm, in a lot of respects, in a lot of counties, we would be making a huge developmental step forward, understanding, as Laurent pointed out, that the Purpose Clause does allow for accountability and community safety. But to the extent we're talking about rehabilitation, we need to take a look to see if our systemic responses are actually making kids worse than they were when they first came to
us. One final question in the statewide version of the program. We have about half a minute left. One of the things that bothers me about this is that in the juvenile justice system, there is no, as Gene put it before, there is no pardon, where there is in an adult system. Judge Kurt Cumley, could you very briefly address that? And we've got half a minute.
Is there a way that a child has the ability to not suffer the slings and arrows of a juvenile record? The law allows for it. It does not allow for it for serious offenses, meaning offenses that can be charged as strikes when adults. And that is something that is an issue under the law. What I would say is, in my experience, the children who are eligible to have their records sealed and destroyed and are susceptible or vulnerable don't seek that option, and they need to consider that strongly.
All right. It is 7:28 and a few seconds after. This is 91.7, your local public radio station, KALW in San Francisco. And this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a program on the juvenile justice system. If you would like to call in, the number is 1-415-841-4134, 415-841-4134. My guests are San Francisco County Deputy Public Defender Greg Feldman, Santa Clara County Deputy D.A. Laurent Hogt. Oh, my gosh.
Close enough.
Terrible. I apologize. I usually don't have a problem with that. In any event, my other guests are Santa Clara County Superior Court Judges Kurt Cumley and Judge Eugene Hyman, who's recently retired. So if you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, a problem that you may have had yourself as a juvenile or someone in your family, don't be bashful. Join us with your question, your comment, etc. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. For a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in the state of California, every county has a Bar Association lawyer referral service. Call your own. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced in the area of law for you for a half an hour consultation, either in person with the attorney or if you can't get into the attorney's office because of perhaps a disability, I think they'll do their best to arrange a telephone conference for you. Depending on the county, for half an hour, it could be a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. It's a great service. So that's what we have for you in case you're interested in that. In the juvenile justice system, it's very interesting that I see here we have not yet had one call, and I am surprised because we have a fairly large audience, and I can't believe that this audience doesn't have someone who's having a problem or has had a problem in the juvenile justice system. So in any event, try not to be bashful and join us. Is the juvenile justice system helping to educate young people who perhaps have had minimal education and need some help in that area? Yeah. Greg, would you take that one on first?
Yeah, I would, and that's something I would love to see more of. We should be in the high schools. We should be talking to kids. We should be letting them know. You know, when I was growing up, two kids could have an interaction. One kid pushes a kid, knocks him over, takes his bike, and rides off down the street. Parents would get together, talk it out. Nowadays, that can turn into a robbery, and that can turn into a charge. That is a taking involving use of force or fear. That could turn into a robbery. That could turn into a kid spending a lot of time behind bars. That could turn into a kid never being able to clear their record, literally having a robbery charge on their record for the rest of their life. The response has changed, and we should be out there. It's something we should be doing. We should be in the high schools. We should be talking to kids.
Yeah. This is Eugene. I'd like to go back to your original statement with respect to education. It's clear that most of the kids in the juvenile justice system have educational issues and probably need, not everyone, but a lot of them need individual educational programs. And we have an expression that can't read, go to prison. If kids don't get a proper education, graduate high school, etc., a huge percentage of them are going to wind up in state prison. You have to be able to read and write, and you have to be able to graduate high school, and you have to be able to have a chance, a shot. And having been in juvenile justice, juvenile delinquency, and to see the frustration of kids that have dyslexia, that have ADD, ADHD, and other kinds of educational issues, and the frustration and feeling stupid. As a matter of fact, when I was in juvenile justice, I was there for 5 years, I actually, as a result of reading all these reports, said, gee, I wonder if I've got some kind of an educational problem. And I was in my 50s when I figured this out. I got myself tested, and I'm dyslexic. And there were certainly times throughout my life where I felt that I was stupid or not getting it or something like that. And if I felt that way, I can only imagine what some of these kids, and they may not be receiving support from their families or
whatever. And their families may not even realize it.
No, or because I've asked kids, are you having trouble in school? Well, maybe we ought to get you evaluated. And the parents say the kid's lazy or something like that. Or maybe a teacher has said that. Not every teacher makes a referral for an individual educational assessment. And that's critical. In order to have a shot, you got to be going to school, and you're not going to want to go to school if you're made to feel foolish or that you can't be successful.
I'd say if there's a common denominator with my clients, it is that they're disengaged from their school experience. They've given up a long time ago, so many of them. So many kids with learning disabilities that have never been properly assessed, they've never been identified. The number of kids, we've got a wonderful situation in our office right now in the public defender's office in San Francisco where we've actually gone ahead and hired an attorney who specializes in education law. And we're finding kids coming through the system with serious learning disabilities. They've never been identified. And they've been seen as antisocial. They get up and they push a teacher. They scream at the principal. That's not necessarily a violent response. That could be frustration in the learning experience.
Yeah. May I ask who the attorney is who's doing the education?
It's a woman by the name of Lauren Brady Blaylock. doing just fantastic work for us these days.
Really?
Educating the courts, opening a lot of doors for our kids educationally.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Karen, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, good evening. I wanted to make a suggestion. I think it's a great idea to have educational courses, and they don't have to be, you know, that long, but about, you know, letting people know about the juvenile justice system and what they would risk if they were caught doing these infractions or assaults or strikes. But I also think that part of that program should be addressed to the kids that are walking around with the $500 iPhones and are walking down the street with their ears plugged up with their little earbuds and are completely clueless to their surroundings and are making themselves a target and are making themselves vulnerable to this. And so they have to also be aware. It's like you tell people, oh, you know, you should get a security system or, you know, sensitivity lights. People are supposed to be proactive. So I think that these kids, too, that are being attacked for these phones, that would be part of that program. And I wanted to let you know that about a month ago in the New York Times, there was an article that said that these kinds of strikes, assaults, and robberies had increased 83% since the beginning of the year. People walking down the street with expensive phones and, you know, their ears plugged up and not paying attention and are getting knocked down and their phones are being taken and their purses and their briefcases ripped off their bodies with their iPads or their computers.
Well, thank you, Karen. That's a very good comment. You know, one of the things that bothers me in this modern age that we have is that it's unusual, I think, that I have found, certainly in the reasonable period of time, of observing people walking on the street is that they're all looking at an iPhone or a cell phone or whatever it is. I rarely see someone walking down the street who's actually, to me, someone who is not concentrating constantly on this thing in his or her hand. It's really, you know, it really bugs me. And, of course, people still are making left-hand turns with a cell phone to the left ear or wherever it may be. Judge Cumley.
I actually would like to broaden this discussion a little bit and step into my other full-time job as a parent, and it is this. I think we are ill-equipped as a society in the way we educate our children with this influx of new technology, whether it is iPhones, whether it's with the use of social networks or sending photos through a variety of means to one another. And there are vulnerabilities, very real issues related to victimizations, where kids that are so caught up in the technology, whether it's having the earbuds in, walking down the street, listening to their iPhones, not aware of their circumstances, or really realizing that every time you send something out through a text or a photograph, this is not a footprint in the sand that's going to get washed away and forgotten
about. It's there.
It is there. Yeah. And in a very number of real cases of which I'm aware, both on the juvenile and adult side, ignorance of that vulnerability or the potential harm that can be caused as the result of it has caused folks to be victimized,
yeah,
and subject to both juvenile and adult criminal crimes. Absolutely.
Let me throw this out before we take our next call. And Karen, thank you very much for joining us, by the way. Is there a problem, at least in your two counties? We're talking about Santa Clara County. We're also talking about San Francisco County. Is there a problem with young people, people under 18 years of age, being stopped for driving under the influence of some, whether it's alcohol or some narcotic? Is this a fair percentage of the cases or not? Greg.
Last year, I probably represented two different kids on DUIs.
So that's not a big deal.
San Francisco is strange, though. When I worked down in Santa Clara County, kids drove. There's something odd about San Francisco,
well,
and
hey,
the kids don't start driving.
It's you shouldn't have a car
age
in San Francisco.
Right? Exactly. I mean, so it's a different population here. Kurt was talking about different counties. It's a different population in San Francisco.
Lauren, what's the situation in Santa Clara County?
I think it's true. There probably is far more driving going on, but I can't say that I think there's an epidemic of kids driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay, good, good. All right, we've got Tiana. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi.
Hi there.
So I just wanted to comment on Karen's call. I turned in late, so I'm trying to catch up. Anyway.
Slow down now. Don't talk too fast. Go ahead.
Okay. So she was talking about, like, basically, I guess, teaching people that they need to be more, like, aware of using, like, their iPhones. But to me, it kind of sounded like she was branching off on this, like, kind of paranoid awareness where you have to be, like, you know, super conscious in, like, these low-income, quote-unquote, areas. And I don't feel like that's necessarily true. I feel like it's more about, like, you shouldn't be using your iPods, but I feel like it's more about making connections and actually, like, interacting with the environment you're in instead of, like, shutting everything out. I feel like that's more of the direction people need to be going in terms of how they're using their technology in open spaces. But I guess you guys had already touched on that, too, with the judge that was talking about that earlier.
Well, let me get some comments for you. Thank you, Tiana, for calling.
No problem, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
I absolutely agree. I used to say this when I worked in San Francisco. I would ride Muni to work, and I don't think in a 30-minute ride I saw anyone speak to anyone else.
Really?
As you say,
no
everyone's
kidding.
Looking down at their whatever their technology is in their hand. And I used to say technology is going to be the end of civilization as
I'll
we
say.
Know it. There's no reason to speak to people. You don't make eye contact with anybody anymore. You don't say good morning or hello as you get in and out. And the kids are sort of taking that to another level because they are even more engaged in their electronics. And I don't think it's just kids that are getting victimized. I think you see on the news all the time older person might be sitting there with their laptop or their iPad on their lap as they're commuting, and someone snatches it and runs out the open door of a bus. So I think it's a problem for everyone, and it's not just low crime or high crime areas or low income neighborhoods. It's everywhere.
If there's a neighborhood, I would say, where I see more phone snatches than anywhere, it's around Union Square.
Really? No fooling. And Union Square is, I think, for most people who are not necessarily that familiar with it, it's the higher level, supposedly higher level of where tourists go, et cetera, et cetera. Very interesting. Okay, do we have any? I guess we don't have. Let me give the number again. 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. And I want to do something that I have messed up in the last 10 minutes twice. My guest, who is the deputy DA from Santa Clara County, her name is Laron Hogue Haught. Finally.
There you go.
Whoa, how's that?
It's really okay.
All right. My other guests are, on your legal rights, San Francisco County Deputy Public Defender Greg Feldman, who was last talking, and then the two judges from Santa Clara County, Judge Kurt Cumley and Judge Eugene Hyman, who retired recently. And Eugene has been a guest on the program several times now, and Eugene is the one who suggested we do this. And I think this is a very important topic that people should take very seriously. All right, who do we – I guess, we have Heidi. Heidi, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Heidi, are you there?
Hello?
Or it's Hedy. Pardon me. Hedy.
That's fine.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I find this a very, very interesting and important topic. I'm a learning disability specialist, and I work with young people. I work with college-age students. I work with children. And I would just like to say one of the issues that concerns me in general is the increasing disparity of educational opportunities for everybody. And the lack of services for youngsters with learning disabilities in the public sector is growing and growing because there isn't money to support it. And I think we need to address that.
Well, let me get some comments for you.
Well, no disagreement here, that's for sure.
Hedy, thank you very much for calling. Anybody else? Yes,
it's
Kurt, please.
Santa Clara County, what about 15 years ago or so now, actually created the first juvenile mental health court dealing with kids that were involved in the system who had any one of a number of mental health issues. But the, and I don't want to say problem I have with the premise, the irony that I find in the premise is this. There are clearly children who are developmentally disabled, who have biological-based brain disorders, who have any one of a number of other lesser mental health diagnostic maladies under DSM-5, but too frequently, it isn't until they've committed a delinquent act and they find themselves in juvenile court that they are appropriately and accurately diagnosed and get help. And it is a problem, not only for mental health, but for kids who have drug problems, and they may, some of them, be dual diagnosis, or it might be kids that have learning disabilities. And too frequently, the juvenile justice system is the place where these kids fall to get the help that if they would have got the help ahead of time, they wouldn't have fallen to us. There is this sense that the juvenile justice system is this great safety net that will catch children and give them the social services, educational, mental, developmental that they need. But I'd like to leave you with this notion, Hetty, and it is this. The juvenile justice system wasn't built to be a great safety net. The reality, because it is a quasi-criminal justice system, is unfortunately, it is the hard floor that kids fall to when the safety nets that should have kept them out of the system have fallen apart, and kids come to us after law enforcement has brought their behavior to our attention. And that needs some rethinking and reconfiguring for a variety of reasons.
Let me do this, if I may. I want to let you know that there will be tomorrow at the San Mateo County Law Library, that's tomorrow, Thursday, at noon, a presentation on identity theft. You're all invited. You can bring your bag lunch. It'll run somewhere close to about an hour. And that's at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City, across the street from the Hall of Justice in Redwood City. And someone from my office, Deputy District Attorney Peter Lynch, will make the presentation. And you'll learn how and why identity theft occurs, how to protect yourself, and ways to determine if you are a victim and what to do. So that's tomorrow, Thursday, June 13th at noon. And if you'd like to get more information, you can call the San Mateo County Law Library at 650-363-4913, 650-363-4913. Okay, let's see. We have Julie. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Julie, are you there? Hello, Julie. I don't know what happened to Julie. Let me read to you something that was brought to me in the studio. A number of Bay Area schools are now reconsidering whether the punishment model is effective. Suspensions and expulsions are on the rise, and these kids are at risk of going down the school-to-prison pipeline. San Francisco and Oakland public schools have adopted resolutions in support of restorative justice as an alternative to punishment. The victim and offender meet face-to-face. The offender acknowledges his wrongdoing and agrees to make restitution and avoids jail time or expulsion. What do your guests think of restorative justice? Is it too radical a shift from the current criminal adversarial punishment model? Question mark. LaRon, no.
I'm sort of shaking.
Do you want me to reread this?
No, I'm sort of shaking my head. I wish people didn't see them as two different choices. There's no reason why restorative justice should only be used for kids who get in trouble at school. It's sort of a false premise that there's no restorativeness, if that's a word, to the system as it currently exists. But I could barely keep Judge Cumley from getting out of his chair while you were reading that question, so I'm going to let him answer more fully.
The victim offender mediation program that was inferred in the last question is a type of restorative justice. But restorative justice really is simply taking the tradition of typical offender-centric justice, whether it's in the adult criminal system or the juvenile justice system, it is always all about the offender. And restorative justice is simply the philosophical shift away from an offender-centric program to bring in an element of community healing and victim restoration, as well as dealing with the offenders. So it takes a single component and branches it out to three components. Victim-offender mediation is a type of that. It is also used and has been used very successfully in the San Francisco County Jail by mm-hmm. Sheriff Hennessy for years mm-hmm. and is still in effect. And there are a variety of restorative practices throughout the state. What works in some instances, is completely restorative, but I've also seen victim-offender mediation not working if a victim has it forced upon them at the expense of the offender. So one of the things that we're learning is clearly, especially in a school context, the punishment model. I've always thought it was strange that when a kid who probably didn't want to be at school did something wrong at school, we suspend or expel them from school. That probably is not much of a punishment for certain kids. But beyond that, and in all seriousness, we have to realize that there is no single magic bullet, that what we need to move to as an individualized treatment model, realizing that what works for different kids in terms of risk and needs is different, and that we make our institutions and our programs, be they restorative or be them completely rehabilitative, really is tailored to the needs of the child and the nature of the offense that brings a child to someone's attention, whether it's police, probation, the schools, or whoever. And I think I agree with Greg, there is far too much of the zero tolerance mentality at the school that came from Columbine that we're finally getting out of. But I think in an abiding sense of optimism that we're moving and evolving in the right direction.
All right.
Chuck, actually,
yeah, go ahead, Greg,
say,
please. Yeah.
My experience is completely the opposite of what's on that question. My experience is the police, the schools are calling the police. Uh-huh. You have police officers assigned to the middle schools, assigned to the high schools, and it's a conversation I have with my coworkers all the time. If the principal wouldn't have gotten on the phone and called the police in the first place, maybe this could have been talked out.
Yeah, good point. All right. Julie, you're back, are you?
Can you hear me now?
I can, sure.
Okay, great. I'm a teacher at the Juvenile Justice Court School in for Alameda County, and I want to piggyback on what the earlier woman had commented, the disabilities teacher. But really, in talking about restorative justice, what we're really talking about, I believe, is that there. If we're going to have restorative anything, it takes so many more resources than we are given. It's labor intensive to take care of these youth. They need attention, and we are not being paid to give it to them. And it's a societal breakdown. I mean, nobody's mentioned gangs. You know, I mean, they're children, and they're looking for things just like grown-ups are looking for things, and they aren't getting them. And as a teacher in public school prior to this, students who are disruptive to class are ruining it for the other kids who do want to learn, or not even want to learn, because the other kids actually do want to learn, but who are able to learn. So that's my comment. It's so deep, and there is so much needed. I'll stop now.
Okay, Julie, thank you very much for coming back. I don't know why we couldn't get you before. With the problem that we have in the courts now with the funding, we have had a very serious budgetary problem for the courts. In my county, San Mateo County, we are losing, I believe, at the end of this month, four of the six commissioners, which means that the Superior Court judges are going to have to rotate and do small claims and traffic court, which I don't think any of them are particularly happy to do. One of the people who is a commissioner right now will be returning to my office as a deputy DA. She was there a few years ago and has been a commissioner. So is the juvenile justice system also a victim of the budgetary problems that we have in our court system? Greg?
I wouldn't just say the juvenile justice system. I would say the educational system.
The educational system.
It should have stopped. A kid shouldn't have to come. As Kurt said, a kid shouldn't have to come to the juvenile justice system to find out he's got a drug problem or a mental health problem or a learning disability. I mean, the number of times 15, 16-year-olds are getting, in my experience, are getting identified as learning disabled. I got a 9-year-old in fourth grade. He's in the public schools in San Francisco. My wife and I are faced with this choice when he reaches middle school. There's not a single middle school in this city that I feel good about.
Really? Oh, my. That's really a great concern, obviously. Frank, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Frank, are you there?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Frank.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So, you know, someone that grew up here and actually in San Mateo County and was someone that was referred to as a truant and dropped out of high school with something like 26 credits, pretty bad case, and you know, for the next decade in my 20s, I repeated every single process, and it was often foundationally what I missed. And I think I'm going to make a statement and ask the question. And the statement, the context behind it, is what I agree with. I just heard right now is that you can't use this one answer to everything. It's kind of like represents this industrial model, this Ford manufacturing line of one answer, one solution for everything. But at the same time, I understand the system is taxed. The system is, in every way, just like what you were referring to as funding, is not able to help everyone. So, you know, my belief is that, you know, what actually the question is, how do we get to a place where there is funding? And a lot of the times it's an emotional action. Someone has to relate to the topic to have that that view to essentially prioritize this. And the second part of the question, I think what's important to me is, what's the failure rate, or from a positive perspective, what's the success rate to be able to say that, you know, there is a 10% of the children in this decade are improving or actually falling into the right place, but in two decades ago it was 5%.
Well, let me get Frank, we're running out of time. Let me get some answers for you. Turn your radio back up, if you would. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, yes, Frank, very quickly. First of all, the good news is 80% of all of the kids that come into the juvenile justice system are one and done, almost without regard to what happens. The ones that require more resources and are more difficult, the frequent flyers, if you will, are that 20%. And of that 20%, the 50% that come back again have yet a higher probability of coming back a third time and a fourth time. So the problem gets more difficult the further you drill down. But one of the things as a judge that I've come to realize is, and this goes to the funding and the individual treatment point that you're making, I realize that the best decisions I make are to find people that can make the best decisions, which is to say, I am not blessed with wisdom that can help children with their educational issues, their mental health issues, their substance abuse issues, their gang identifying issues. But if I can be a resource broker to hook them up with the folks that can do that, it is a much more high yield proposition, especially from a court perspective.
We are nearly out of time. There's a question that was written and brought into the studio here. In case a child is deemed to have mental health challenges, is there a program available to rehab him, her, in order to expunge criminal charges from the record? Very briefly, does anyone have a comment on that?
Well, to a certain extent,
yes, Eugene.
Thank you. So, to a certain extent, it depends upon what the crime is, which is unfortunate,
as
Kurt was mentioning earlier, that if there isn't intervention sooner, then the short answer is going to be no. The issue is in terms of identifying. Then it depends upon the county resources, and it depends upon the seriousness of the mental health offense. Santa Clara County has a juvenile mental health court that tries very much so to intervene and to get appropriate medications and other kinds of interventions, and they're extremely successful. But it's labor intensive, and not everyone's able to do that.
I want to thank you very much for joining me and those of us listening to you on the program. Thank you very much, Santa Clara County Superior Court Judges Kurt Cumley and Judge Eugene Hyman, recently retired. Santa Clara County Deputy District Attorney LaRon Hogue-Haught and San Francisco County Deputy Public Defender Greg Feldman. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Legal Rights production staff members are Program Engineer Joanne Marr and Production Assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. If you're going through the unfortunate situation of getting or thinking about having a divorce. Join me next week. We're going to be talking about using alternatives to litigation and traditional mediation in dissolution of marriage. My guests are family law attorneys Estelle Rosenfeld, Jill Mondry, Lauren Zorfus, and Mu N. Stieg. Thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney.